For the week of October 18th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 299, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
How is New York with the Mets winning?
Cold. It's cold. It's very, very cold.
I've noticed. I've been watching, for those outside the country, the Major League Baseball playoffs are on right now, and it's the New York Mets versus the Cubs because the Los Angeles Dodgers lost. And I will tell you, watching the playoffs is like watching a bunch of snowmen play. I mean, they're all bundled up, all of these baseball players.
Well, it's cold. It's cold. It's a high of 54 today. But, you know, that's what happens in the fall. It's going to get warm up a little bit. But now, of course, we're headed to Chicago. So the Mets play in Chicago on Tuesday night, I believe.
Is the city just going crazy right now because of the Mets?
No, because Mets fans are too fearful of being excited, too scared, too cynical, too wary. They're like, no. They don't want to get ahead of themselves. They're very quietly excited, but they don't want to get, you know, Yankee fans like, yeah, we're going to win. Mets fans are like, I hope we don't lose. You know, it's, you know, decades of training. So, you know, they're actually a little more tentative. They want to, they believe, they're excited, they're focused, but they are not feisty.
Well, isn't one of their slogans, you gotta believe?
Yeah. They're like, we're too scared to believe, I think is their new slogan. But that's baseball, but we're here for entertainment.
That's right. But before, well, I appreciate you asking what we're going to talk about this week, but I guess I should let listeners know that we may not be here next week.
And well, you're letting Michael know as well, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, I'm doing it this live. Michael is hearing it as our listeners are hearing it. The SMPTE conference is next week, I just realized.
Bless you.
Yes, exactly. The Society of Motion Picture Television Engineers. They're holding a conference here in Los Angeles. I don't know whether I have to go on the day we normally record, so I will definitely be in touch with you, Michael, to let you know whether we can record next week.
And you'll probably tweet out and Facebook out and all that sort of stuff when a decision is made, if the episode's not going to happen. How would people find all that stuff?
Well, they can follow us on Twitter. @ShowbizSandbox is our username. Or you can follow us on Facebook or like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, you'll find our page and you can like us there. Or you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us. Fax machines love to call us, by the way. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And of course, Michael, you know this. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, Stitcher, the Microsoft Marketplace. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free is usually where you can find our podcast, and you can rate and review the shows in those aggregators as well.
All right. Well, good to know. Let me know when you know about next week. Let our readers know. You might even tell them, hey, yes, there will be a show.
That's true.
You know, why not?
Could happen. Yes.
And what are we going to talk about?
Next week or this week? Because
this week.
Well, on this week's show, we're actually going to be talking about the gender pay gap and gender equality in the entertainment industry.
Because who better than two men to discuss
this? That's right. And we can't tackle the entire world. We're just going to focus it right down to the entertainment industry. It's once again a topic of discussion for a number of reasons, not the least of which is an opinion piece written by none other than Academy Award-winning actress Jennifer Lawrence. We'll hear what she had to say and how at least one of her frequent co-stars has plans to take up the cause with what could be a very effective strategy. Meanwhile, the music...
It's called the Friends strategy.
The Friends strategy. Ooh, I think you've just coined that term, actually. Or has it already been coined? I don't know.
As far as I know, I just made it up.
Okay. Well, you're like Shakespeare. You're making up words like, I don't know, what was...
Well, it's Friends, the TV show, not Friends, Friends.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Keep going.
All right. Well, the music industry, Michael, you've always been saying it's been contracting for more than a decade now, not only in sales, but with the big six record labels down to only three now. Well, the same is happening to music publishing, and it looks as if Sony ATV may soon have a new owner. So could one of the world's biggest and largest music publishers soon merge with a competitor? We'll try to answer that question. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're talking about the worldwide box office. We get our information from Rentrack, and we pull other info from Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, The New York Times, Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profits, and everybody agrees. The number one movie around the world is, yet again, The Martian, Matt Damon's sci-fi epic. Another $58 million over the weekend. $320 million around the world and counting. A big, strong, solid success story for Ridley Scott. It's his first in a long time, isn't it?
Yeah. What was his last film? It didn't do well at all. Like, it was just, I can't remember what his last film was. Prometheus?
Ouch.
No.
Yeah, Prometheus was probably his last film.
No, it was the one with Christian Bale. Exodus or something like that.
Oh, right. He's had Exodus, Gods and Kings.
Yes, that's it.
Before that, he had The Counselor. Before that, Prometheus, Robin Hood, Body of Lies. American Gangster got some good reviews. And then a good year, that very weak film with Russell Crowe. Kingdom of Heaven, which I think probably eked out a profit, but was not a success. Matchstick Man. It's really been Black Hawk Down since 2001, I would say, is the last time he's enjoyed critical and popular success. I think that's very safe to say. Before that was Hannibal. And then, of course, before that in 2000 was Gladiator. But it has been a long, long time since the heyday of Gladiator and Black Hawk Down. But I'm sure it's nice to be back on top with a movie, both critically and popularly successful. Speaking of that, is Ant-Man, a movie that came out and people questioned and they wondered, is this a success? Is it not a success? Is it weak? Why did they make a movie about Ant-Man? Well, Ant-Man opened in China. Thank you, China. $43 million over the weekend. It's $450 million worldwide and counting. It will certainly get past $500 million. It is the best launch of a Marvel film in that particular universe, in the one being done now, not counting Spider-Man, because that's a different company. Ant-Man is bigger than Thor, bigger than the Hulk, bigger than Captain America. Their first movies, Ant-Man has done more money, made more money, more successful.
But is that because of ticket prices? And I don't mean that.
No. Within the last decade. No, it's perfectly, come on. We don't have to. It's not like 40 years ago or something, or 80 years ago. It's well within the last 10 years. All those movies, did decently. First one, the second one typically did better, except for Hulk. They haven't made one yet. So Ant-Man, Paul Rudd. A very, very successful launch for yet another Marvel character. At number three around the world is Hotel Transylvania. I didn't count Guardians of the Galaxy because that's like a group.
Really?
I didn't count Guardians of the Galaxy. That's a group, right?
What are we talking about now? Did you go backwards?
I did go backwards because it's another. I was realizing I didn't mention Guardians of the Galaxy. I was thinking of single superhero movies like Iron Man, Hulk, Thor, and Captain America. Guardians of the Galaxy is kind of the same idea. It's a Marvel movie. That certainly was, it's not as big as that. So Iron Man and Guardians of the Galaxy are above, way in a whole other level than all those other secondary characters. But Ant-Man has proven itself as a, decent, well-reviewed, very successful launch.
Okay.
Adam Sandler's happy too. Hotel Transylvania 2, another $40 million over the weekend, $270 million and counting. Guillermo del Toro, however, is a little sad. His movie is Crimson Peak. It's sort of a scary movie, right? Yeah, it's not a horror film. It's sort of an old-fashioned haunted house scary type of movie. It made $26 million over the weekend. It opened in 56 territories, and nobody liked it anywhere in the world.
Really?
Well, it's gotten poor reviews. We expect, like most horror films, it will fall hard in its second weekend because it's certainly not getting great audience buzz. And those movies tend to be front-loaded. That certainly was the case over the weekend even. You could see on Friday it made a certain amount of money and then was passed up Saturday and Sunday by other movies here in North America. So this is another movie that has underperformed, I think, for Guillermo del Toro. The shine is definitely off of the man who made a terrific movie. What was the Oscar winner called?
Pan's Labyrinth? No.
Pan's Labyrinth. Okay. Terrific film. And then he fell out of The Hobbit. And ever since then, he's been making things like Pacific Rim and Crimson Peak. And they're all passion projects, and he's so excited by them, and they're just not delivering. But what is delivering is Goosebumps. The R.L. Stine series has probably sold like hundreds of millions of copies of books. I don't even know how many, but it's a long, long-running kids' book series, and it's finally been turned into a movie. Jack Black is the hero. He plays R.L. Stine, who writes these books, and then suddenly the stories start to come to life. That's the premise behind the movie. There will be more than one because it made $23 million over the weekend and had a very good launch here in North America. And it's one of the biggest starts yet for Jack Black as a leading man.
Wow. So all of these, people who aren't normally leading men, Paul Rudd, I guess he's becoming a leading man. And now,
he's been in lots of romantic comedies. He doesn't carry tons of films, but he's been a leading man for a while, I think.
Yeah, I guess Jack Black has too. So,
yeah, but Jack Black's been the leading man in like small indie films. He is not, other than School of Rock, he hasn't carried a film. And here he's carrying a big film again. So it's definitely a franchise and it's definitely going to work.
Okay.
And number six is Goodbye, Mr. Loser. That's that Chinese time travel comedy about a guy who goes back to high school. Another $22 million over the weekend, $185 million and counting. Pan wishes it had made that much money. That wouldn't help it, but at least it'd be better than what it's doing. This is the Hugh Jackman origin story for Peter Pan. Another $20 million over the weekend. It's in 53 territories. It's made $72 million worldwide, which is half of what it costs to make. It's going to open in China soon. It's not going to save it. This is definitely a big, big flop for Warner Brothers.
I'd say so. I mean, they're thinking of that maybe they'll have to write down possibly $150 million.
Well, that's what it costs to make. And then, of course, you got to market and do all that and pay people.
Yeah.
And I love those. Whoa, this big flop movie may actually cost money. It's yeah. Like the headlines are sort of weird. Like, oh, they may have to write off a lot of money off this flop. Well, that's what a flop is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And number eight is The Intern, which is a more modestly budgeted Warner Brothers film. $16 million over the weekend, $135 million worldwide and counting.
I'd say that movie is making money.
Yes, you know, but again, there's probably good hefty back-end deals for people involved, right?
Maybe not. Well,
no,
not
Robert De Niro?
Nancy Meyer? You know, when he does a movie like this, he gets paid up front a lot of times.
Like this?
Well, when he's not...
commercial?
Yes, correct. A commercial romantic comedy by a big studio that, yeah, he's going to get paid up front.
Well, yeah, he's not doing it for love, but you're saying that the $40 million reflects all the money he's getting already?
I don't know if it reflects all the money he's getting already. Well, certainly it reflects his salary. We know that much. But how much of a back end will he get? I don't necessarily know that there's going to be a huge one. Back ends aren't for everybody these days. You know, not everybody gets a back end.
All right. And Robert De Niro is not a huge box office draw in a sense, right? I mean, he is a big star. He's an incredible talent, but he's not a guy who makes tons of movies that open to tons of money.
That is correct.
So maybe he's used to just getting his paycheck. On the other hand, we bring this up because of Bridge of Spies. Crimson Peak, of course, cost $55 million to make, and everyone is immediately writing it off as a disaster, even though it made $26 million over the weekend. It made more in North America. Did it make more in North America than Bridge of Spies? I think it did, right?
I believe
no,
so.
No, Bridge of Spies. No, oh. Bridge of Spies just edged it out here in North America.
Yes.
So this is a movie from Spielberg, stars Tom Hanks and the great Mark Rylance. It costs $40 million to make, and everybody immediately thinks of it as a big success story, right? $50 million over the weekend here in the U.S. It's going to have legs. It got good reviews. People liked it. It's going to open all over the world. But the fact is, $40 million is a joke.
Well, and I talked to one of the producers who was very upfront about the budget of $55 million. Now,
He's raised it up to 55?
Well, wait a second.
Don't say with tax credits and all that.
I don't know whether that was A, with tax credits, or B, he was referring to the marketing budget on top of what was spent to make
the
movie.
You think they only spent $15 million to open it? I guess maybe that's possible.
In the U.S.
Right.
Yes. Possibly. I don't know.
Right. So, but the idea that this movie costs $40 million to make is a joke.
No,
Spielberg and Hanks alone are $40 million walking in the door for
a
movie like
and that,
this.
That goes to show you, and I asked about that. I said, well, you think Spielberg and Hanks would garner like $20 million salaries? And he looked at me and he said, it's not the 1990s. Like,
yes,
you know,
it's not, but they're getting back in. I picture them making, you know, the money comes pouring in. We sold a ticket and they hand him $20 and Spielberg goes, thank you very much. And then they go, we sold another ticket. There's $20. And Tom Hanks says, thank you very much. Well, I'm sure they didn't get $20 million paychecks up front. But as far as the money they're going to make off this movie, if it succeeds, surely that's where we're talking about.
Well, I do know that for Spielberg, it was a DreamWorks Pictures movie. So he certainly makes the money because if this movie makes money, he's the production company. That's right. How he's going to make, just like all of those musicians that own their own record label, you know, that's how they're going to make some money. Well,
so all of this is to say, when we talk about is a movie profitable, is it not? We have no idea. We don't get to see the books. All we can do is go based on the budgets that somebody leaked or somebody took a stab at and everybody else started to repeat as if it's true. We actually don't know, but it gives us a vague ballpark figure. And with a movie like Bridge of Spies, we can put an asterisk by and say, yeah, okay, $40 million, but it better quadruple its budget if they hope to make money, because you've got two big players in there who probably are involved in the back end.
Well, I asked, what do you need to make for this movie to, for you and the studios to be happy? In this case, I believe it's Touchstone. It's Disney. And for the movie to make money, what do you need to make in your domestic opening? And he said,
Domestic opening?
Yeah.
Opening weekend?
Opening weekend.
Why would you ask that? I want to know what they need to make, period. Who cares about opening weekend?
Well, there's triangulation here. He's not going to give me two. So he said, we'd be really happy with 15, which is where we think it'll be. We'd be ecstatic with 17. But they know that this is not a movie that's going to fizz out in its opening weekend.
Right. And we all know that.
Yeah, and they know that Tom Hanks plays well overseas. So they're incredibly happy.
Not incredibly happy. They'd be ecstatic then, in which case it made $17 million. But as if that extra $1.7 million would make all the difference in the world. What matters is where it ends up. And I'd say they have to make $200 million to be really, really happy. That's my prediction.
That would be...
Worldwide. Why not? It's $40 million to make. Spielberg and Hanks worldwide.
Yeah, worldwide. I mean, I think Lincoln made what? Like 200 and some odd million dollars. So that was like one of his biggest films ever. Spielberg's biggest film ever. So I don't know.
It made $273 million worldwide. And I wouldn't say it was one of Spielberg's biggest films ever by a long shot.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That's true. About? Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah, no, I meant like on that par, on par with.
His smaller,
yeah,
beloved film.
Yeah.
Of the small films that don't make a lot of money, it's one of the more successful ones. You so belong in Hollywood. All right, if we haven't bored everybody yet, there's Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials. That certainly doesn't have a lot of profit participants, but it made $11 million over the weekend. It's at $255 million worldwide, about $100 million short of the first movie. We'll see where it ends up.
Can we drop all the way down to probably something we should have talked about first? And it's what a lot of people are talking about here is The Beasts of No Nation from Netflix.
Okay.
This is a film that opened, of course, day and date, video on demand on the Netflix service. They took out tons of ads. There were tons of news stories about it opening in the same time, 31 theaters, all landmark theaters here in the United States, and on Netflix, all at the same time. Big Toronto movie, big awards movie, at least Netflix hopes so. It won lots of praise at the festivals. They're hoping it's a high-end film, and they spent $12 million on it. Cary Fukunaga directed it, the guy who did...
$12 million to option or $12 million to make and market it?
To acquire it. They acquired it.
But they didn't. That doesn't include marketing, right?
Probably not. No. Right. They spent $12 million.
So they spent more than $12 million. Yeah.
Right. And it earns in 31 screens $50,000.
Right. A $1,600 per screen average, which is pathetic.
Yes. And now, just to give you some kind of, the Toronto winner room was on four screens. Okay. Only four. It made $120,000 over the weekend on four screens. So
and jobs of 2 weeks or 3 weeks, gonna made $100,000 on one screen, whatever. Yeah, it's a beast known by any stretch of the imagination, whether you're on three screens or 3,000 screens, a $1,600 per screen average is weak. Very, very weak. You've got a flop.
Yeah, well, a flop theatrically, I think because I don't think they cared about the theatrical release.
Of course they care about the theatrical release.
Well, I don't.
Why do you say they don't?
Well, if you looked at all of the ads that I saw, none of them said in theaters. They just said Netflix presents Beasts of No Nation. They never said where it was. Now, all the news articles talked about it being in theaters, but there were only 31 theaters in very specific areas that, these aren't huge theaters. They're landmark theaters. Some are big, some are smaller, but it's just not. I don't know. They did not push the...
And how do you think that makes the director and the stars feel? If they feel, wow, they barely mentioned the fact that this movie is opening in theaters, they could only get it on a 31 screens, and they couldn't open it, in, to say the least, with any sort of audience at all. Gee, my next movie that I hope is an Oscar hopeful, I'm not going to bring to Netflix.
Possibly, yes. And
right.
Well, Cary Fukunaga has...
If they'd gone straight to TV, they maybe would have had an Emmy winner, right?
Correct.
So Netflix was, hey, you know, that Oscar is overblown. You know, don't you really want to win an Emmy, you know, or get Emmy nominations? We can do that. All right. Well, so now you're telling us you can't open movies. You know, even if you've got great critical acclaim, you cannot even get people to show up on opening day. You didn't even try because your ads were misleading or confusing.
So
that makes it harder for Netflix to open up their next movie. So of course they want a success in a movie. They want to show if we have a movie and we release it theatrically and we spend the money, we can make that work. And they didn't succeed here. No. It doesn't mean it's a disaster or whatever. Do they think it's a valuable property added to their library? I'm sure they do, but I'm sure $12 million is a lot of money. They'd rather have had it, you know, do better to prove both other filmmakers should be eager to work with them, prove that they can make this happen and work, this new formula, this new way of doing things, and they haven't succeeded their first time at bat.
No, and Fukunaga, the director, he did True Detective, so he's used to doing television as well as feature films. And he said, look, you know, more people will see this movie
on Netflix than
will ever have seen it if it was just on in the theaters.
Well, that's ridiculous. That's not true.
And
that's
completely
wrong. That's absolutely wrong. People see movies on Netflix and on cable and pay-per-view because it plays in movie theaters and people actually hear about it. How many people have heard about Beasts of No Nation? A lot fewer than if it actually had a good, successful commercial run. So the idea that more people will see it, now they don't know it exists.
I would agree with that.
A big flop and they say, well, that sounds like a bad movie. I don't want to see it.
Yeah,
so
I would agree
wrong.
With that.
He's absolutely wrong.
Well, you know, I think Netflix wants to go after both Academy Awards and Emmys. I think they're going to find...
Right, and they didn't do it the first time out, and that's perfectly fine. They're trying something new, but let's not pretend they don't care. Oh, they don't care about whether it worked or not. They're perfectly happy. They're delighted it didn't work. You're like, give me a break.
Well, something new, speaking of something new, is the NT Live, National Theater Live. It's not exactly new since they've been doing it for about 2 years. But yep. I see you kind of asked a question here in our show notes about, okay, so you had 225,000 people worldwide watch Benedict Cumberbatch play Hamlet last week in this one night only, you know, it had what, 1,400 screens play across 25 countries.
That's right. Some people saw it time delayed, but most saw it as it happened.
Right.
It was Hamlet live with Benedict Cumberbatch. And they announced, trumpeted the news that most people ever to watch a live national theater event. It did really well, but we don't know is how much it grossed.
Well, just to give you some sense, if everyone paid $20 for it, it would have made $5 million in that one showing, okay? Just that one showing.
Well, just that, it is only one showing.
Actually,
it's a live event. They do reruns, but yes, those are far less well attended. The appeal is seeing it while it happens.
Well, and it, because this particular event did so well and is getting so much press, not only because it did well in theaters, but also because everybody's raving about Benedict Cumberbatch and this particular production of Hamlet.
Well, not everybody's raving. No, it got mixed reviews. It got friendly reviews. But no, people were not raving about the play itself. It's just he's a star and he's a white hot celebrity and everybody wants to see him.
Okay, well, you know, there certainly was
a lot. It is not the most acclaimed Hamlet of our lifetime by no stretch of the imagination.
At the end of the day, what I'm saying is a lot of these things will show up in theaters and they'll be well attended and you never hear about them ever. In this case, you actually have heard about it. And you know what the number one question everybody asks after reading the articles about it? Well, how can I see it in theaters? How can I see it? Is it going to be on TV? They're going to do encores? They're going to do so many encores. You should see how many encores they've scheduled already. And it's not just one night. They're doing it, you know, 2-3 nights in a row. Now,
this is a rerun of the actual performance, not a new live feed of him doing it
correct.
In person.
Yes.
Right. Right. They have encores for opera and other stuff. And sure, they're saying it's our most successful of all time. So I'm sure they'd have a few more encores than usual. They're not going to probably do anywhere near the business. And they probably won't even report the numbers. And that'll be the sign that it wasn't a huge, you know, these typically do not do well in reruns.
Typically, so, yes. In this case,
we're thinking maybe this grossed $4 million worldwide, which is great, which means it would be on our list if it was reported like other stuff. It would probably be like number 19 or 20 worldwide.
Correct.
As far as just compared to all these other movies that played all weekend with, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 performances or however many of them, this did it in one night. So good for them.
Right. We've talked about tracking before. And I don't know whether we need to get into this, but there is the story of Spectre tracking to open at least domestically to $80 million.
You mean in North America?
In North America. When it opens on November 6th.
Well, is that a surprise or
no? They're saying it would basically that pre-sales in London have been double what they are for Skyfall. So it'll be interesting to see whether that tracking holds true or not.
Right, because we've been saying tracking has been a little weak and a little off. This James Bond is not something that's hard to track, though, is it?
No, not really.
You got a long, long history of the movies. You know, you look at opening weekend, Skyfall grossed $88 million in its opening weekend in North America. So I would certainly expect Spectre to make in that ballpark. But it's certainly, you know, it's trending upward. You know, I mean, There's no reason to think Spectre would do less than Skyfall, is there? So $80 million opening. I don't need to do any tracking to say Spectre should make about $80 million opening weekend.
So what you're saying is that everybody should be tracking things like Paranormal Activity, the latest Paranormal Activity installment of that franchise, because, you know, now some of these chains like Regal and Cinemark, they're not playing the film because it's going to be released early on VOD. So
right, this is just like Beast of No Nation, right?
Well, no, because
this is a new era, and Netflix is saying, hey, we're going to show it day and day, and they're like, go away, we don't want your movie. In this case, they said, hey, look, come on, Paranormal Activity. After a few weeks and Halloween's over, nobody's going to care about this movie. So let us go quicker to VOD and we'll give you a slice of the profits. One or two chains said yes. Most said no, right?
That's right. And so now everybody's saying, well, you'll actually be able to see the impact of not opening in circuits like Regal, Cinemark, and some of these medium-sized circuits. You'll see the difference.
Well, I don't know that you will, because it's hard to know what would have happened if...
Yeah, good point. Although, actually, you have five previous movies to kind of look at, I think, or four previous movies to look at. So maybe, maybe not.
Okay. So, you know, the next week is when Paranormal Activity, Ghost Dimension opens up. It'll be fun to watch that. The Steve Jobs movie, which is still tearing it up. It made $1.5 million over the weekend on just 60 screens. That's a $25,000 per screen average. So that's been very, very popular in limited release. That goes wide next week. So does Vin Diesel in The Last Witch Hunter. Clearly Halloween is looming. Bill Murray in Rock the Casbah and Jim and the Holograms. In general, except for Steve Jobs, it looks like a lot of weak stuff.
Well, you know what isn't weak stuff is this letter. I don't know whether it's a letter or a piece, an opinion, op-ed. I don't know what you'd call it. But Jennifer Lawrence wrote this essay, if you will, titled, Why Do I Make Less Than My Male Co-Stars? Question mark. I don't know if I needed to say the question mark, but it's there. So she actually submitted it to and published it through Lena Dunham's new, I guess it's an email newsletter on feminism or a feminist. I don't know what it is. But here to talk about it at the very last minute is Karen Woodward, who is not only one of the entertainment industry's leading social marketing consultants, but also a former host here at Showbiz Sandbox. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, guys. Great to be back.
Now, Karen, isn't this time where you should confess to people why you actually left and walked away from Showbiz Sandbox?
Oh, guys. I got so busy doing what I was doing, and I was starting to focus more on social media and less on entertainment as a whole. I just didn't feel like I had that much to contribute anymore unless it was something specific to social media.
The truth is, Sperling was paying himself more and me more than you, and you're like, what? You found out the contracts and you're 30% of nothing is still nothing, but damn it, I want the same nothing that you two have.
I didn't realize you were walking me down that path. Now I realize that's exactly what you were doing, so my bad.
Yeah, we've gotten a lot funnier since you left, Karen. Can you tell?
Clearly, to be fair, you guys were always pretty funny.
No, we haven't gotten funnier. So, Karen, have you read this essay? Have you talked about it? What do you think about it?
I have. You know, I think she makes two really good points, one which is perfectly valid and one which is not valid at all. There's no question that women are paid a good deal less in the entertainment business. No question. And it's completely unfair. It's total BS. And I think that a lot of it has to do with sexism, and a lot of it also has to do with the point that she made, which is that women are afraid of not being liked, and they're afraid of speaking up for what their fair share. I think it was unfortunate that she made the comparison using the movie that she did, because her role in that movie, which the name of it's escaping me,
American Hustle is the name of the movie.
Thank you. Her role in American Hustle was not as big as Amy Adams' role. So if Amy Adams had made this argument, she would have had a better one. So there's no question that if their roles had all been equal, she should have gotten as much, frankly, if not more, than her male co-stars. But she didn't choose the right movie to make this comparison.
Well, I guess let me ask you this, too, because, and I'm going to end this piece, she wrote, when the Sony hack happened and I found out how much less I was being paid than the lucky people with, male genitalia, but she doesn't use as polite a word as I just
did. Yeah.
I didn't get mad at Sony. I got mad at myself. I failed as a negotiator because I gave up early. I didn't want to keep fighting over millions of dollars that, frankly, due to two franchises, I don't need. And she goes on to say that she just wanted to be liked, as you said. I guess because a lot of this essay is somewhat, I don't want to say crass, but it's very direct. It's very blunt. And it doesn't always use nice language. Do you think that weakens her argument at all?
Well, I think it shows the audience she was writing for and the tone and style that they were going for, right?
Yeah. I mean, if she had written this for Vanity Fair, she wouldn't have written it the way she did. This was Lena Dunham's email newsletter, and she wrote it as such. Whether her crassness took away from her argument, my guess is that she probably included those words on purpose, thinking that her crassness actually was part of her argument.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, she kind of concludes the piece by saying, I'm over trying to find the adorable way to state my opinion and still be likable. So she's basically like, yeah, you're going to hear me say that other word for male genitalia a lot more often now.
I mean, you know, there are a few other points that I think are worth making about this whole thing. And that is that her agent is a male. Her attorney is a male. So that's interesting. And definitely one of them was the one that she speaks about in the piece. Hey, we're all on the same side here. Definitely one of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, most definitely. So, I mean, I don't know for sure. That's my guess. So can she blame her agent somewhere in here?
Well, technically, the answer to that is yes. And a lot of people, and I can't remember who it was that wrote this. I think it was maybe it was Roy. I don't know who wrote it, but they were saying that that she should be blaming her agents, who should have pushed harder. However, that is part of the problem when you're negotiating. As you well know, Karen, from working at a talent agency at William Morris, you know that you don't know what some of the others are being paid, some of the other actors and actresses, or even the above-the-line talent, unless it's a favored nations deal. So you're kind of... Yes, I know what you're going to say. If the people are represented at the same...
When you have agents working at that level, you can find out.
Yeah, I mean, especially if the talent is at the same agency. In this case, I'm a little surprised that somehow they didn't find out.
Well, here's what I would say.
So that also brings... But that also brings up something interesting, doesn't it? So, you know, we weren't a fly on the wall, so we don't know. They might have said to her, we know we can get more. And she might have said, I don't know, let's just close it at this. We don't know that. She implies that from what she has written here, but it would be interesting to know the full facts.
Well, and they very well may have said to her, hey, look, your role is not as substantial as, you know, Amy Adamson's or Christian
Bale's.
But that
shouldn't matter for the pay. Like, no guy says, he says, I'm a big star. I get this money. You know, it doesn't matter that I got 14 less lines than somebody else. So I'm a bigger star in bigger movies. And whatever my role is here, I deserve big bucks.
Sometimes they go by how much time it takes, you know.
Yeah, but not when you're a big star, you know.
No, I don't disagree. I mean, and to your point, I mean, when was the last time anybody really cared about fairness, right? I mean, if this was switched and she had been the star of this movie and Bradley Cooper had the smaller role, I would be willing to bet that he would have made as much as her, if not more, simply because he's a guy. I mean, I do think there's a lot of truth to what she's saying. There's absolutely no question that women are paid less.
Well,
not just in the movie industry, in general.
Well, not anymore for Bradley Cooper, because he is actually, first, he applauds what Jennifer Lawrence had to say. And from now on, he's going in to do these group negotiations for salaries with his co-stars, so that it's not just him negotiating, but he will say, I want my female co-star to make as much as I am, and we're going to negotiate our contracts together. So it's
bully for him, but I would love to see that actually happen. His agents will laugh at his face.
Well, it's the friend's approach to negotiating, and that works when you've got a series or you've got a project like American Hustle, where you've got an ensemble, but it certainly doesn't work for a lot of different movies, you know, movies where you're the sole lead and, you know, Who are you gonna? A lot of movies, there isn't a good female role. So who are you partnering with to get the same money? You know, it doesn't make sense for a lot of movies. But I want to talk about the social media aspect. A friend of mine immediately reacted to this and said, "Oh, this makes her look so bad, bitching about how much money she makes for a movie." I'm like, "Well, she was funny about it, and she made clear she understands that, you know, she's already got more money than she needs. That's not the point." And I go, obviously, it starts the conversation about equal pay for equal work in all areas, not just Hollywood. But I'm sure this is something you assume, Karen, that she sat down with her team about and talked about before she just tossed off a thing to Lena Dunham and had it posted online. And what would be the impact, and how should I word it, and what's smart about this? You know, would that be something you'd hope the star would do?
I'm sure this was well thought out. She is not on social media, but, you know, Lena Dunham is. And hopefully her team was smart enough to have thought this through. I'm sure they were. And my guess is that she probably did this simply to start the conversation about this, not necessarily to make herself look good or bad. I think she probably didn't care that much at this point. But what's interesting about her as an actress and as a person is that she's using her fame to help other people. And I think that was probably what her goal was with this.
Well, what do you think about what Lena Dunham has done with this email newsletter? It's called Lenny, which I assume is Lena, Lenny, you know, and it's
she has a partner named Jenny. So it's a portmanteau of her name.
Well, I can't figure out, is it a, how would you describe it? I want to say it's a feminist newsletter, but I don't want that to sound, you know, derogatory. I don't know.
It's not a
excuse me, that is. It seems like the word feminist is derogatory.
Exactly.
I would call it a feminist newsletter, and I would think that I consider that to be a good thing.
Okay, I didn't. Well, you know, I guess I didn't know if that.
You're a man.
Yeah, I'm a man. That's right. Hold on, let me check. Yep, still a man. I had to check my male genitalia, or what what Jennifer Lawrence would call. No, I'm not going to.
Yeah, they're calling it a feminist newsletter, Sema. Uh oh. It's not Rush Limbaugh world here, you know?
Well, I didn't want to pigeonhole it either, I guess. You know, I didn't want to basically say, well, it's only going to be focused on this topic.
It's only going to be focused on the majority of the population of the world, women.
50%.
More than 50%.
51%, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, then
women are a majority, period.
Well, I guess that makes sense then that Kathleen Kennedy, well, now the head of Lucasfilm, but a very well-known producer, a senior producer in the entertainment industry, she said, look, we want a female director for Star Wars. In this franchise, we want a female director to helm one of the future Star Wars films. Is that part of the reason?
Is what part of the reason?
Is what part of the reason?
The 51%. I did not ask that question as well as I could have, I think.
No, I want to say to Kathleen Kennedy. Who's stopping you? You've already announced about 9 new Star Wars films. I believe they all have male directors attached to them. If you want a female director, call us when you actually give one part of the franchise. Telling us, oh, we sure would love to do it. If only we could make it happen. Well, what's stopping you?
I totally agree. That was my first thought, too. It's like, great. Okay, hire one.
Well, who would you hire? I guess Catherine Bigelow.
This isn't my area of expertise. You guys should probably know something off the top of your head, but I mean, Catherine Bigelow is an obvious choice, but there are a lot of Catherine Bigelows that don't have the opportunity.
Right, the woman who's made a great short, who's been on TV, who's done you know, great work in television or elsewhere, and then you jump up into a big franchise like all these obscure guys who make one small indie film, and then suddenly they're handed, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy. So, you know, there are women out there working, ready to do it, who will succeed, who love Star Wars and know the franchise and know the world. And if Kathleen Kennedy wants to give one a job, nobody's stopping her.
Okay, well, I think we should start a social media campaign to kind of, I guess, lobby Kathleen Kennedy to get a female director on the next Star Wars film. And if we were to do that, Karen, how would we start?
Well, first of all, we shouldn't have to start a campaign. She said it herself.
Well, that's true. But, you know, that was my way of saying.
you know, this is the kind of thing that I'm not sure, you know, that's a big question. There are a number of ways to do that. I think that the entertainment business sort of has an intrinsic problem in that it is run by men for men. Actually, it's run by men for 14-year-old boys. And that's, I think, really the problem. It happens. The change needs to happen on a different level.
And, of course, we know that majority of tickets are bought by women. And they also are the driving force in choosing movies. So the idea that it's made by men for 14-year-old boys is kind of stupid, since that's not even the majority of your audience. So it's bad business sense, what you're doing right now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are so many, you know, female, quote-unquote, female movies that are out there that do really well. And you look at, like, Fantastic Four, which was such a joke of a bomb. You know, people, the entertainment industry needs to reassess.
Well, I think, you know, I'm sure that there would be somebody who would argue, hey, we say that every year.
I know. So let's make the change happen.
Right. So let's not have Kathleen Kennedy say, gee, it would be great to have a female director for Star Wars. Let's just give somebody the job and then announce it.
Yeah. Thanks for the lip service, sweetheart. But let's see what you got.
So, Karen, Jennifer Lawrence, not on social media, probably a sigh of relief for you when celebrities realize maybe they shouldn't just spout off at the mouth when they're online, or do you like to see them more engaged?
Oh, I love to see them engaged. I wish that more of them thought before they posted and tweeted, but I wouldn't include what she wrote as part of that. I think what she wrote was very much thought out.
Oh, absolutely.
Please, nothing makes me more giddy than seeing a celebrity totally screw up on social. It's great, right? But I think that you have to remember, too, that it's not just celebrities who screw up on social. Everybody screws up on social. You just don't have the same, you know, amount of people who are watching you screw up. I think that the audience on social takes things a little bit too personally, and so it means that people can't joke or be sarcastic without getting in deep trouble for it, and I think that's unfortunate. I don't want to see celebrities get watered down on social. I think they need to be smart, but it's kind of saddens me to see what they get in trouble for when clearly their intentions were not bad.
Well, you know, I'm a celebrity and I have your number, right? So if I needed help with my tweeting or Facebooking or Instagramming or Snapchat, wow, there's way too many of these now. I know how to reach out to you, but if I'm one of those celebrities that doesn't have your number, how do people get in touch with Karen Woodward when they're a celebrity and they've really messed up on social media and they need to have somebody help them?
You can visit me online at KarenWoodwardOnline.com. And my Twitter handle is Karen_Woodward.
I would have thought it would have been the real Karen Woodward.
I'm not quite that pretentious.
Well, Karen, you know, when Michael saw that I had put this story of the Jennifer Lawrence piece in the show notes, he said, well, maybe we should get Karen because we're two guys. We can't really talk about gender equality. So thank you very much for joining us at the last minute, literally the last minute. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thanks a lot. What a good idea it was to reach out to Karen Woodward and ask her to talk to us about gender equality and finally confess why she left the show. Sperling wouldn't pay her enough.
Yes, I really want to make 100% of nothing, actually.
Well, 100% of nothing is a big deal.
Oh, you see, here I was going to thank Karen, but I think really what you're trying to do is move us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, how could it not be our first story? Because every 12-year-old boy in America is now crying. Because Playboy is going topless-less. Okay, now, I did not stutter there. Yes, the magazine that pioneered nudity is putting on clothes. Playboy pushed the envelope with its photo spread, but was soon outpaced by rivals. Penthouse was raunchier, and other outlets specialized in various body parts and seemed more gynecological than sexy. Playboy proudly stayed true to its sexy self, but a relatively wholesome niche, as they saw it, well, as they saw it, I suppose. But then came along, of course, we all know what happened, right? The internet. Now that every conceivable image and video is available at the click of a button, Playboy has decided to drop the nudity entirely, starting in March of 2016. They'll keep the sexy poses, but drop the full nudity. Photos will be PG-13, the sex columnist is an empowered woman, and there may or may not even be a centerfold. On the first cover of the revamped magazine, guess who it's going to be? Gloria Steinem. Okay, no, just kidding. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
I'm shocked. I'm shocked and stunned. There's actually going to be a Playboy magazine in March of 2016? Is that the commitment they're making? Because the fact that this Pepe isn't under now, I mean, they're down to 10 issues a year. They have very little ads. I'm waiting for the death now. I'm waiting for them to go out of business. I don't know why they haven't. I guess the name is valuable for merchandising and stuff a little bit, I guess. But as a magazine, it's been dead in the water for quite a few years now. And they're actually saying, we're going to keep going. But this is a desperate, ridiculous thing. Is there anybody in the world who says, I would love to subscribe to Playboy, I just wish there wasn't so much nudity?
You know, the next time you see somebody reading Playboy and you catch them reading Playboy, when they say, no, I'm just reading it for the articles, they'll actually mean it.
Well, no, the articles are good. It's a good magazine. But I don't think there's some audience that is suddenly going to flock to the magazine and increase subscriptions because of this decision.
No, but
it's just not true.
I think what it did do was remind people, oh, yeah, that is a good magazine. You know, for the articles.
It's a desperate, desperate pass. And it just means they're delaying the inevitable of canceling it forever. Just a few more months.
We should actually do a show on how would you save Playboy?
You can't. They needed to save Playboy 20 years ago.
Well, show done. I'm going to check that one off as done. Presidential frontrunner Donald Trump, I never thought I'd be saying those words, will host Saturday Night Live on November 7th. NBC may have insisted it cut ties with Trump after his negative comments regarding Latinos, but they're still willing to put him on their shows to goose ratings.
And by negative comments, we mean racist and hateful.
I didn't want to change the word negative, so you can do that. But yeah. And does this mean every other Republican candidate gets to host SNL? Because that would be nice. They need to, you know, meet equal airtime rules. The FCC's equal airtime rules. There goes the season, though, if that happens. But I might watch Ben Carson. The musical guest on that particular week is Sia, S-I-A. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I'm waiting for some cast members to refuse to go on air. Remember when Andrew Dice Clay went on Saturday Night Live and people said, I'm not going to perform with him. I don't want to support this guy. You know, Donald Trump isn't just like a presidential front runner. He's sort of race baiting. And surely there are some Latino and Latina people or Hispanic people or cast members, or I wouldn't want to be the musical guest on his show. You know, it's going to get good ratings, but do you want to be involved in helping him push towards the presidency? It's not like Republican versus Democrat. It's somebody that you see literally as a demagogue who is spreading hate in order to, you know, push forward his campaign. And I'm shocked that nobody has yet said, I don't want any part of this.
Well, you know, I would predict that Sia, the musical guest that week, will not show her face on that show.
What?
Meaning that she never shows her face. She yeah. performs. Although it would be interesting if she had Donald Trump do the lip syncing.
Though actually, I'm sure it'll get good ratings, but so did the Democratic debates, by the way. They drew 15 million people to the first Democratic debate. Not as much as the Republicans, which had like 23 million people, but 15 million is a crazy big, especially for a field with a lot fewer candidates and seemingly a front runner who's still going to proceed ahead and win the nomination, which is Hillary Clinton, which is the Bernie Sanders fans will disagree with me, but that still seems to be the case at the moment. So less tension and drama, a much smaller field, and still people flocked to watch that debate. Amazing.
What did you think of Larry David portraying Bernie Sanders on the...
You're implying I actually watched Saturday Night Live,
okay.
And I don't.
Yeah, he did a great job as Bernie Sanders on the opening of Saturday Night Live this week. It was very funny.
That's funny, Cassie, but now he's got to commit for the rest of the campaign, right?
I wondered. I was like, why don't you just hire the guy? You know, just he was.
Well,
just,
he doesn't need the work.
I know. He was just so funny. He's like, we're doomed. Well, the weepy drama, Goodbye, Mr. Tumor. We talked about it at the opening of the show during Box Office.
No, we didn't. That's a different movie.
Oh, you're right. It's Goodbye, Mr. Loser, and this is Goodbye, Mr. Tumor. That's right. They have a lot of Goodbye movies in China. And now, in fact, Goodbye, Mr. Tumor is China's official submission for the Best Foreign Film Oscar. You might be asking why, and that's because Wolf Totem, a smash hit based on a Chinese bestseller about the Cultural Revolution and filmed in Mandarin with a Chinese cast, was ruled to be not Chinese enough. In fact, the film was a co-production between China and France, like so many films that have varied countries involved. The director is Frenchman Jean-Jacques Annaud. The composer is American James Horner, and that, along with some other elements, led the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences to determine that the movie was creatively in control by the French. Annaud takes issue with that, saying the rules are vague and confusing, wondering why they don't count the cast. producers, and the language spoken when determining a movie's country of origin. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal, not for China as such, though they haven't even gotten onto the shortlist for like a decade or more. But I think it's a big deal as far as the rules do need to be clarified, because it's so confusing. You know, there are all these countries and all these co-productions and all this international melange of people that make movies. And as a no points out, hey, how come in Hollywood they get a Hungarian director and a German star and everybody says it's an American movie? You know? That's been the case for decades. But when it comes to other countries, suddenly it's confusing. And frankly, you know, if you're making a movie in Mandarin, doesn't that alone make it seem like, okay, that's a Chinese film?
Yeah, well, I think
it's in Mandarin, for God's sakes. You know, if it's in Ukrainian, is that a language? Then it's Ukrainian. You know, it just seems like the language seems to be a huge element. So when they do tax stuff for movies and tax, they have all these sort of elements that they figure out. You get points for this and points for that and points for the other thing to qualify. The Academy needs to either come up with something more complicated that takes into account all these factors like the cast and the language, or they just need to say something like, you know what, you know, let's let the country decide what movie represents their country. We have the right to reject it as they did here, but you better have a good reason. And if it's in the language and it tells a Chinese story starring Chinese actors about a Chinese event in history, okay, the director's French, but they're not trying to pull a fast one.
Or as Chris Dodd liked to say in regards to Ampass, you're not helping here. but yeah, I do think it's ironic that here you're right. There's nothing written down per se. Oh, I guess there is actually, but it's
confusing.
It's confusing. Kind of like when you're trying to get your film into China, the rules.
That's funny.
That kind of qualify you as a co-production. They're kind of written down. What's the word I'm looking for? Nowhere.
That's
so,
right.
It's ironic that this should be happening to China of all countries, where, you know, they kind of make their rules up as they go along when it comes to financing and everything like that.
And whether your movie actually gets shown in their country.
Yeah.
We'll let you know. No.
Yeah, exactly. Why? Because why? Because
so
we said
shouted
so.
For it, or do you think that they actually believe that this movie is not Chinese enough?
I think that they probably believe it's not Chinese enough. I also think that really, you want to call it, it's the best foreign language film. Okay, so go by language and financing. That's
when I also say it should be called the best international film. I think I like Ted Turner's thing that he did at CNN, where he said, stop saying foreign, say international.
Yeah,
he's
okay.
Like, don't say foreign. Foreign makes it sound strange and weird and dangerous and something you don't understand and dark and mysterious. Say international. It just means it's part of the most of the world that we're not in. And I think that the best foreign film makes it sound like, oh, foreign. It's not a film for you. It's foreign. You know, that is the sort of subtle implication of the word. Just say the best international film. And yeah, certainly language would at least clarify it a bit, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would.
It ain't in English, you know. You know, if it's in French, by God, it might be a French film.
Not a week goes by in which Netflix doesn't make some kind of news. Last week, after the streaming video subscription service announced it had missed third quarter estimates for earnings, revenue and subscriber growth, that was like a hat trick there, the company's stock plummeted over 7%. Unfortunately, that means it's up only a measly 120% since the beginning of the year. Or, as market analysts like to call it, quote, still the highest performing stock in the S&P 500, end quote, for the year. But apparently Wall Street was expecting Netflix would now have 69.7 million subscribers, but it only got a fraction of that at 69.2 million. And revenue was a paltry $1.74 billion instead of the expected $1.75 billion. Netflix tried to distract investors from news of its embarrassing earnings by making some news of itself by expressing interest in expanding into news programming. Think Vice, not CNN. Big deal or big whoop?
Woo, a lot going on there. So we feel like investors and other people are overreacting to news. You know, they come up with magical numbers that they have to match. And if they slightly under, they're like, oh, it's a disaster. You know,
right.
How's Netflix doing? It's a mature business in North America. It's got room to grow overseas. They've increased their subscription price in North America, and customers don't seem to be revolting. It's certainly not getting coverage that way. And, you know, that's one way to raise revenue. Another one is to decrease expenses, which is tricky. But yeah, it's a mature business. Doesn't mean that they're still not making money. So I think they were overreacting too. As for this news thing, yeah, it's not like they want to launch a 24-hour news channel or evening news. They just want to do they've been doing documentaries for a while. But
I know, that's why I was like, why are you saying that this is new? This is, you just wanted
because they want to do something regular, like a 60 Minutes or Vice, or, you know, their version of that. Just like they've upended television and how TV shows are shown, or, you know, doing it all at once and doing it online. Just like they've done it with hopefully Late Night, where they've got Chelsea Handler and they want to upend that world and how that's done. Now they want to do it with news.
Well, just to let you know how important Netflix is, or at least how important the media believes Netflix is, this past week there was a conference here in Los Angeles. There were 6 or 7 major network executives on the dais there, on the podium. And it was a panel discussion, and they were all talking amongst themselves. And Ted Sarandos, the head of content for Netflix, is up there. He says one thing that is in response to John Landgraf over at FX. He's the CEO of X, and this summer he said, hey, there's too much TV. You know, there's just like 400 channels and 400 new shows, and it's just, there's too much TV. Well, he said there's no such thing as too much TV, is the direct quote. The headlines that came out of that, forget about the fact that there were 6 other people up there. It was all about Ted Sarandos and Netflix.
Was that just because he said the most quotable thing?
I think it's because you put Netflix in your headline and it's clickable.
All right.
You put some of these other people out there, they don't have, name recognition. Netflix and Ted Sarandos now have name recognition in headlines.
And, of course, he's wrong. You can't make 10,000 movies a year. There's not enough talent to go around. It would be unwise. You'd make 10,000 week movies. You know, you cannot make 500 good TV shows a year. There's just not enough talent to go around. We see it in sitcoms. When was the last great sitcom? You know, there is such a thing as too much TV. When I feel overwhelmed and I can't feel like I can't keep up with things and I got to cut things off early, yeah, there's a little too much.
Yeah. And he, you know, he says things all the time that I'll leave it at that. He said a lot of stuff about Beasts of No Nation that I kind of went, really? So I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. But we'll see how the future unfolds. Meanwhile, zombies aren't just popular in America. The hit TV series The Walking Dead opened to some big numbers overseas, and unlike Game of Thrones and Downton Abbey, they're working hard to make sure the show doesn't need to be a hit in piracy, because, you know, every time Game of Thrones airs, it's, you know, pirated immediately. The new season
launched... Because it's not available everywhere all at once.
That's right. The new Walking Dead season launched in 127 countries simultaneously for Fox. That's possible due to Fox's global reach with satellite services. So while the show's latest premiere enjoyed a big jump over previous years, it might have done bigger numbers if it had played on a terrestrial network like the BBC or Channel 4. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I think just like movies are worldwide now, TV shows are worldwide, and we rarely get the numbers for, like, how much money are they pulling in? How well are they doing in all these territories and things like that? And so this is one sign of that. And fighting piracy is another sign of why you want to open up worldwide as quickly as possible. It's a show people want to see. They're all familiar with it. The sooner you get it to them and let them watch it legally, the less likely they are to steal it.
Well, I'm going to skip around a little bit here in our news lineup, our big deal, big whoop lineup, because Fox airs these shows, The Walking Dead, overseas in international markets, okay? But here in North America, or at least the United States, it airs on AMC. And the director, Frank Darabont, and AMC are still fighting it out over The Walking Dead. Darabont jump-started the project and brought it into the cable channel. He was then fired in the midst of season 2, but his name, at least, remained on the credits as executive producer for all the episodes. Darabont is suing, saying that in a classic case of self-dealing, AMC has quote-unquote sold the show to itself for a low price. Worse, he says, AMC unilaterally lowered his cut. AMC fights back with various explanations, notably that he doesn't deserve to be fully vested in potential profits because he didn't actually oversee all the season 2 episodes.
Because they fired him.
Yes, exactly. they'll go to trial sometime in 2032. That's right, 2032. Assuming the details aren't too embarrassing and AMC settles up before the case faces a judge, and you know they will. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop until it actually happens and goes to trial, right? Yeah. But I do love the idea, like, well, you don't get all the profits because you didn't do the whole season. He's like, well, I didn't do the whole season because you fired me.
Right.
You know, so like you see you've got a big hit and then you get to fire the guy the last episode before he vests and say, oh, sorry, you didn't make it over the finish line.
Yeah, well, and every like 10 years, there's a self-dealing lawsuit where, you know,
because they keep self-dealing.
Yeah, because, you know, for instance, FX is Fox owned, yeah. right? So Fox, which produced The X-Files, sold their series, The X-Files, to FX at a much reduced cost. David Duchovny won that lawsuit because the judge said, yeah, you're self-dealing. You can't do that. You have to sell it at a fair market rate.
It's not self-dealing because they sold it to themselves, because they sold it to themselves uncompetitively at such a low price.
Correct.
You could demonstrate that this was less than you would get on the open market.
That is what self-dealing is, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying because they sold it to their own company doesn't mean it's self-dealing.
No.
Right. It could have been competitive, and it could have been at a fair market price, in which case it would be fine for FX to win the rights to the X-Files. They just got to pay the right market price.
It's like transfer pricing.
I'm looking forward to the X-Files when it comes back. Good reviews for the first episode.
India now has the sixth largest market in the world for books. I figured this was a story you'd like, Michael.
Absolutely.
But first, some clarification. First, it's sixth largest market for English language books, okay? Second, this includes trade and school books. Still, India as a whole had $3.8 billion in sales in 2014, including both trade and textbooks. The country has 22 official languages, but books in English make up 55% of the trade market and even more of the textbook market. The UK had $2.6 billion in sales, and India just edged them out. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, of course, because it's a big growing market, and there's a lot of room for growth. I mean, there's still a lot of India that is mired in poverty. So the fact that they have a big, strong middle class and people who are reading books from around the world is a great sign, and that there's, a huge upside potential, just like in China. I'm a little confused, though, why we're making this distinction between languages. I just want to know is China the number one book market? I don't know. I mean, whether it's in Mandarin or English or French or German or Russian, I don't care. It's just like, where are books being sold? Whatever language it's in, I don't care. Just like, movies when they're subtitled, I don't care. Like, how much money did the movie make worldwide? How many people bought Harry Potter? I don't want to know what Harry Potter sold in English. I want to know what it sold, period. So I'm a little confused about them making this distinction between, in English language books. Well, why not just tell us the total? How many books did they sell not in English? So that confuses me a little bit. But yeah, India is a good example of who needs bookstores. They're going to leap over bookstores. Just like parts of Africa went from no telephones to cell phones, India is going to go from no bookstores to people getting books on supersized phones, and they buy it directly from the publisher or bookstore that way without needing an actual physical bookstore. So there's a lot of room for growth in that country.
The Mercury Prize is one of the hipper music awards now, a good look at what's happening in the UK beyond boy bands and big acts. This year's nominees have just been announced, and they run the gamut from Aphex Twins to Wolf Alice and Benjamin Clementine. The award is for the best album of the year and invariably sparks a good bump in sales for the winner, depending on how popular they already are. This year's Mercury will be awarded in November. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for me. I got a lot of work to do because I have not heard almost any of these albums. I've heard Wolf Alice and Florence and the Machine, but there's a lot of music here that I have not been paying attention to. So I got to work. I got to listen to Slaves and Jamie XX and C. Duncan and Aphex Twins. I got to get going.
Well, and it's Aphex Twin. I know somebody's going to write to us and say, yeah, I can see the emails in the inbox already.
My fault. Typo.
Well, speaking of music and getting band names correct, there's a music festival showdown taking place in New York City. After various producers tried and failed, Governor's Ball finally succeeded in making the ever-popular music festival work in the Big Apple. This year, the fifth festival included acts like Lana Del Rey, Ryan Adams, Bjork, My Morning Jacket, and Drake. I should go to this thing. Wow, it sounds really cool. Now they've got competition. The major promoter AEG is trying to launch a festival called Panorama to take place just 2 weeks after Governor's Ball in 2016. Their event would be held in Queens, and while they haven't secured a venue, they've already booked acts, or they're already beginning to book acts, a hostile act since only one festival could feature the same act, if you get my drift. Now the folks behind Governor's Ball are petitioning the mayor to reject Panorama. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, obviously. But yeah, if you've got a successful music festival, you don't want to undercut it by letting a competitor come right in and start to beat up on them just when they've established themselves after 3 or 4 or 5 years. So it seems reasonable with while you want competition and you want people to be able to bring their own festival, make them happen too, to say, hey, we've just established this, letting someone else move in right during that calendar period. Let, just like the acts have a certain blackout period, maybe the festival should too. You want to try and launch a festival in New York? Great, but you can't do it within this, you know, 12-week period. Is that reasonable or is that crazy?
12 weeks is fine. I mean, part of the issue that you have is there's only so many touring acts out there at any given time. Okay, so not everybody.
They're both going to be competing for the same acts, and obviously, if one gets them, the other can't, and you can't have two festivals succeed 2 weeks apart.
Doesn't matter
what acts they've got. They could have all different acts. No one's going to go 2 weeks. Most people are not. They're going to pick one over the other. So why undercut the one that you finally just got established? But again, it's tricky. It's like, well, then when are you just not allowing competition? Da da da. But it seems fair to say, hey, do it in August, right?
Yeah, or do it in September. Yeah. Although September's so hurricane season. Yeah, exactly.
It's New York.
Just ask the New York Mets.
I know what annoyed you about this story was how everybody said Coachella's taking over New York.
Yeah, the Coachella. I mean, that's why I clicked on this story. It said, they want to. Oh, the governor's ball is petitioning the New York City mayor to block Coachella offshoot. This has nothing to do with Coachella. Okay, AEG owns the promoter which puts on Coachella. They own Golden Voice. Golden Voice puts on Coachella. They put on a couple of other festivals, but kind of operate separately. I realize they're under the umbrella AEG, but Coachella and Golden Voice have nothing to do with what's going on at this Panorama Festival.
So who are the people behind Panorama?
Is it
AEG starting from scratch, or is it some different company?
It seems like it's AEG starting from scratch.
Why didn't they ask the Coachella people to do it?
I'm sure they have, and I'm sure there's some crossover at some point, or maybe some crossover at some point if it gets serious. There may be some crossover, but there are different companies within AEG.
So your point is, yeah, it's the same umbrella organization, but the creative talent who makes Coachella special are not, at this moment, involved in Panorama, so don't pretend they are.
Right, and right now, I mean, you go to Coachella and you see Golden Voice everywhere. It's Golden Voice, if you look at the stenciling on all of the equipment, it's Golden. It doesn't even say AEG, because Golden Voice, in and of itself, is a company, and Golden Voice puts on Coachella. It's just, if you want clicks on your headline, you put, Coachella's coming to New York.
What about putting Coachella merges with Netflix? You know, that would give you some click.
Oh, my God. You'd break the internet, I think. If you did that, the internet would put Kim Kardashian in there, and I think the internet would actually catch fire.
All right. Well, that's it for Big Deal, Big Whoop, isn't it?
Yeah, it's time for Inside Baseball. That's where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we're going to be talking about Sony ATV. You might not know who Sony ATV is. And you know what? Sony ATV is actually, they're fine with that because they are a behind-the-scenes player. They own the copyright to 3 million songs. And so they are a music publisher. They're the people that if you wanted to go and do exactly what Ryan Adams did, which is he covered all of the songs on 1989, Taylor Swift's album, you have to pay the copyright holder, the publisher, if you will, for the right to do that. So you don't have to pay a mechanical royalty, you have to pay a publishing royalty.
What's a mechanical royalty?
A mechanical royalty is if you were using the actual song that Taylor...
Like playing it on the radio.
Yes, that's when you actually have to pay for using a specific recording.
Happening to Sony ATV?
Well, this is a company that since 1995 has been owned by Sony, and ATV, which is a company that Michael Jackson purchased in 1985 for $47 million. So it's a music...
Bargain!
Yeah, it was a...
Paul McCartney is still pissed he didn't outbid Michael for that one.
Yes. Now, you might be asking, what the heck, Paul McCartney, ATV, Michael Jackson, what's going on here? A bargain? Why would somebody pay so much just for a publishing company? Literally, ATV owned all the publishing rights for the Beatles catalog. So he bought the Beatles music. That is, Michael Jackson bought the Beatles music, at least the rights to it. Needless to say, Paul McCartney, you're right, was very upset with Michael Jackson, and it kind of ended their friendship.
Because they were supposed to be friends, and Michael secretly outbid him. Paul finally had the chance to reclaim the Beatle catalog, and Michael was like, oh, sorry about that. Yeah. Did I spend more than sorry about that, Paul?
did you not have $50 million?
ATV wasn't just the Beatles catalog, right? It was a lot of stuff, but it included the Beatles catalog, yes, which is obviously a plum.
Right, and then Sony came along, and they merged the companies, Sony Music Publishing and ATV, mainly because Michael Jackson was so in debt he needed money. So Sony bought an equity stake. Yeah.
So now what's happening with Sony ATV?
Sony wants out. Sony needs money. Sony, as you may know, is not doing too well these days. They need money. They value the company at $2 billion, although there's some dispute as to, you know, analysts saying that company is not worth $2 billion.
So one of the biggest publishing catalogs in the world is up for auction.
Yes. However, ATV, the Michael Jackson estate, which owns, you know, half 50% of Sony ATV, can buy out Sony or can find a strategic partner or can be bought out themselves. The problem is this. Here are the potential suitors. Warner Music Group would be one of them. However, you know, A, they're the third biggest record label, and they also have their own publishing company called Warner Chappell. Okay, so
it might get blocked by antitrust.
Yeah, that's part of the issue there. Then there's the rights management company, BMG. Okay, they are, you know, kind of a subsidiary of German media outlet Bertelsmann. And they're saying, no, we have no interest in this at all. Even though this is what we do, we are
Why
a music
not?
Publisher.
Aren't they interested?
I think they don't like the valuation. Yeah,
oh, okay.
and they don't like the regulatory issues. They don't like all the money it will cost them to try and do the merger. They don't like the valuation. It's too expensive.
And that's the same problem for Universal Music Group. They're a big titan, but they too think that the antitrust hurdles will be too big for them to take it over.
Yeah, I mean, they just purchased, I can't remember who, what was it? Was it EMI? No, Sony EMI. I can't remember who they purchased, but they purchased somebody turning the big four record labels into the big three record labels. Uh-huh. And it was just a nightmare. And so they're like, no, we're taking ourselves out of the running early. We don't want to go through that again.
So one of the most viable publishing companies in the world is available, and almost everyone seems afraid to jump in.
Except private equity, which is what I think will happen. I think there will be a private equity owner of this. So here's what you will see happen. It will probably take between 5 to 10 years. You will see private equity move in, buy a controlling 50% stake, take Sony over, give Sony the, you know, however many millions of dollars they or billions of dollars they want for their share. And then about 5 years later, you will see the private equity try to get out and sell it again to probably a strategic partner or a strategic buyer.
And Sony ultimately will regret giving it up.
Yes, because right now there's a lot of question as to the royalties coming back and what the copyright really means, because, you know, with all these streaming services, there's a bit of a question as to how much, you know, what the royalty should be for the publishers. And once that gets worked out, they could make a lot of money. But they're saying, yeah, that's true, but we need the money now. We need that cash in this moment. To give you some sense as to how much revenue was earned last year by Sony ATV, $591 million in revenue from music publishing in its most recent fiscal year. And that's actually, according to the company itself, it was up 6% from the previous year. So it's not a small business. It's a big business.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm just reading a biography of Frank Sinatra. I've read stuff about Ray Charles. You want to own your masters and you want to own the publishing. Never give up the publishing when you're a songwriter.
That's right. And that is why someone like Dolly Parton, is beyond the fact that she's, you know, hugely well known and has had a great career, but she's probably made more money from publishing than she has from selling records of her recordings. I would not be shocked.
Absolutely, because she's not a huge album seller anyway.
That's right.
She's had a long and storied career, but she's not selling 10 million copies of her albums. She's going platinum, you know, gold platinum, couple multi-platinum in there. You know, an incredible career, great talent. But as a songwriter, gee, I will always love you. You know, there
yeah.
you go.
You know what she would say is, I'm not going platinum, I'm going blonde. But, you know, I guess this would where we would usually have listener email, but we're running so long. Maybe we will hold an email from some of our listeners until, well, next week or the week after. What do you think?
Sure.
Okay. And I know you hate it when I do that, Michael, don't you?
Yes. Then either read the email or don't, but don't tell them we have one and we're not reading it.
Well, should we read this email? What do you think?
Now you're holding me hostage. I'm saying just either read it or don't, but don't tell them you've got it and aren't going to read it. Now you can't read it because you make it sound like a second-class citizen.
Okay, well, we're going to read it. It's from Andrew Einsbrook from Wild Pure Heart Productions. He's our friend from down under, as I like to say. And last week, you may recall, we talked about how well films are doing in Australia. Australian films doing well in Australia. Go figure. And he kind of points out the same thing. He says the screen business here relies heavily on government subsidy for development and production support, mainly in the form of tax offsets. Maybe it is not an apples-to-apples comparison, but the percentage of UK or French domestic product is much, much higher. There are many reasons for this. We are awash with product from other English-speaking countries, probably the United States. Budgets for Aussie films tend to be comparatively much lower, $1 to $10 million. There are exceptions that go higher. But they still have to compete head-to-head with The Avengers and others. But anyway, good to see Australians seeing Australian movies in somewhat higher numbers this year. Talk soon. Cheers, Andrew. So, Andrew, thank you for writing in. He was explaining why some of the Australian films might be doing a little bit better down under this year.
Yeah, you should be able to hold your own more in Japan because you're not competing with a lot of other movies in Japanese. So that's right. A good point to make, though. The UK, obviously, they're English language territory as well. But he says, hey, in the UK, they've got more government subsidies and they've got bigger budgets. Thank you for pointing out those issues for us. I'm still surprised that the Aussie film industry isn't a little healthier because I've been seeing them for so many decades and just hold it in such high regard that in my mind, they were a lot more competitive on the local market.
So if you are Australian and want to complain about Michael saying that your film industry is not healthy, please write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. That's what Andrew Einsbrook did when he wrote in. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, of course, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, as I mentioned at the top of the show there. All of this information, as well as links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our Twitter handle. And I guess maybe we should ask Karen for some consulting advice on how to deal with our Twitter account, as well as our Facebook page. Search for us on Facebook. Our account can be found under, guess what, Showbiz Sandbox. In fact, you can find all of this information, again, on showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's ilovevegemite.com.
Oh, I get it, because it's Vegemite is from...
Because you made it sound like I was saying something bad about Australia, and I wasn't. Everybody knows. Keep going.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, try the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com. Actually, archives a bunch of Michael's work. You can also head on over to bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until possibly 2 weeks from now, we'll find
out. For our 300th episode, I might point
out. That's right. So we're not sure when, but we will have a 300th episode in either 1 week or 2 weeks. But until then, play nice.